You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The following podcast includes explicit language. In other words, might get a little blue in here. Hope you can handle it.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine, Slate's national editor, and this is Hang Up and Listen for the week of June 21st, 2021. On this week's show, we're going to talk about whether the NBA is to blame for all the injuries in this year's playoffs, and we'll look at what happened with Kevin Durant and Ben Simmons. Slate's Mark Joseph Stern will also join us to assess the Supreme Court's decision in NCAA versus Alston, a unanimous ruling against the college sports business model. And author David Epstein will be here to assess the strange case of Shelby Houlihan, the American distance runner who claimed she tested positive for a steroid because of a burrito. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm the author of The Queen and the host of Slow Burn Season 4. Also in D.C., Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Josh.
And with us from Palo Alto, Slate staff writer, host of Slow Burn Season 3 and the upcoming Season 6, it's Joel Anderson. Hey, Joel.
What's up, man? I need to check and see if Senor Cici, my favorite burrito place here, is put a little nandrolone in my burritos, man.
I've been feeling good. You can ask for an extra dose.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've been feeling pretty good working out. You know what I'm saying? Maybe that's what it is.
You're going to double up on that pork, Joel.
Yeah, that's right.
We should make it very clear that Joel's favorite burrito place, we have no evidence that there's any... anything in the burritos. I'm sure they're amazing burritos.
Can I admit that I didn't know what pig offal was? I thought that was, I don't know. Is it like chitlins or what kind of pork is that? Do y'all know what that is?
Offal are the entrails and internal organs of an animal used as food.
Oh, it's like chitlins then.
Organ meat.
Really? You can have a chitlin burrito?
Well, I think it's just that they use the internal organs and they mix it in with the meat.
Well, we'll get into this a little bit later.
Well, we're really not going to get into what's in pig offal.
My grandmother would be very excited to know about the existence of a chitlin burrito. So we'll see if it comes
closer. Before you get to the NBA, I did want to double back to something I talked about on last week's show, which was during our conversation about Christian Eriksen's on-field collapse. I mentioned the Formula One driver, Romain Grosjean, whose car caught on fire during a race, and that scene was on the F1 reality series Drive to Survive. Counter to what I said, Grosjean did not retire from driving after that race. He's actually now racing Indy cars. So thank you to all the listeners who schooled me on that and who reminded me and all of us that it's always a good idea to verify what you see on reality TV.
And since we're doing corrections, I think I said that Christian Eriksen played for AC Milan. He played for Inter Milan.
I didn't make any mistakes last episode, so.
Good job, Joel.
Thanks. So the NBA's Final Four was finally set Sunday night after the Atlanta Hawks pulled off a Game 7 upset of the top-seeded Philadelphia 76ers in the Eastern Conference semifinals. Thus, the last teams standing in the league are now the LA Clippers and Phoenix Suns in the West, and Milwaukee and the Hawks in the East. Of those teams, the one that most recently won a title was the Bucks in 1972, which is, you know, half a century ago. But it's hard not to think about which teams might still be playing if not for an unprecedented rash of injuries to All-Stars, like Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving. 8 NBA All-Stars have missed playoff games due to injury, and make that 9 if you include Chris Paul, who's currently in the league's COVID protocol and missed Game 1 of Phoenix's win in the West Finals. LeBron James, who himself played through an ankle injury in the Lakers' first round defeat, took to Twitter in a particularly self-aggrandizing fashion to point out he'd warned about starting a new season so soon after the end of the previous one. "They all didn't want to listen to me about the start of the season," LeBron tweeted. "Sorry, fans. Wish you guys were seeing all your fave guys right now." So, Josh, who do you think the "they" is that LeBron is referring to? And do you think that he had a point?
No injured players in Space Jam 2, I think, is the important thing. Also, you forgot about the injuries that Ben Simmons suffered when Joel Embiid and Doc Rivers drove a bus over him. After the
he's got
Sixers.
Train tracks. He's out for the next season.
After the Sixers lost Game 7. I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute, though. But to answer your question, they and LeBron's tweet, I think, definitely include the league ownership and the commissioner's office. But it should also include the players' union because they agreed to this year's condensed schedule. It didn't read to me like LeBron was calling out the union and his BFF Chris Paul. But the point is that the pandemic forced every industry and every individual to make choices between unpalatable options. And what, in this case, the league and the players decided is they didn't want to lose hundreds of millions of dollars by starting the season late and playing a lot fewer games. And so I think that's that. And there is a lot of data that suggests that injury rates were higher this year. Kevin Pelton of ESPN says there were more players out per game due to injury than during any season since he started tracking it in 2009, 2010. And there are particular injuries that fit in with this narrative of condensed schedule, soft tissue, whatever, like Kawhi Leonard, for instance, with the Clippers and his knee injury. Like, that would make sense with this. But the thing that's nagging at me a little bit, Stefan, is with LeBron James, he had like an enormous dude fall on his ankle, which, I mean, I don't know if Solomon Hill was like addled because of the condensed schedule and that's what made him fall onto LeBron. And maybe it's like LeBron is old and so he doesn't recover as well as he used to, but that also doesn't have to do with the condensed schedule, or maybe it does a tiny bit. And then, you know, the other most notable injury of last round was Giannis just like slamming his enormous body onto Kyrie Irving's ankle, which again has nothing to do with a condensed schedule or, you know, starting the season late. Like, Kyrie Irving didn't play that much this year. He was extremely well rested. And so on the one hand, I think if you do look at the numbers, there is a story here. But a lot of the reason why we think that injuries have predominated and are the big storyline is because of these like notable all-star injury moments. And I just think it's really hard and maybe misleading to attribute those to some larger trend.
Yeah, this is a merging of narratives, right? You've got the frustration among players that they had to come back after the sort of record short layoff. I think for the Heat and the Lakers, it was 71 games, the shortest, you know, in the history of the league.
And it doesn't seem like a coincidence that they both flamed out in the first round.
I mean, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I mean, the merging of the narratives is that it's a convenient, maybe not convenient, maybe legitimate, but it is an explanation for why top players and top teams have flamed out of the playoffs.
You were going to say excuse, but you decided to be kind at the last minute.
You noticed that, didn't you? Yes, yes. I mean, the reality is that players get injured all the time. All-stars get injured all the time. Kevin Durant got injured during the playoffs a couple years ago. Klay Thompson didn't play in playoffs because he got injured. This is not unusual. What is unusual is that LeBron James lost in the first round, and it was really hard for him, and he got hurt. And yes, other players have gotten injured as well. I mean, it's hard to know for certain when you look at each of these individual cases, whether they are related to the pandemic and the condensed schedule, or whether, as you pointed out, Josh, there's a cruel fate in playing sports. People get hurt. These are not mutually exclusive occurrences, right? The fact that we're not seeing some familiar names, and that certainly it's contributed to teams losing in the playoffs, should not also overlook the fact that, hey, Giannis didn't get hurt. He's still playing. Trae Young's still playing. There's still some really damn good players that are still playing.
Well, I would like to push back just a little bit, because if we read Tom Haberstroh's piece from about a month ago about NBA injuries, he points out in the piece that falling down is a sign that players aren't at their peak, right? And the way that LeBron got hurt, falling down. The way that Giannis stepped on Kyrie's ankle, and you know, the sort of stuff that is happening, yes, it does seem sort of random, but it also is a piece of players being tired.
Potentially, yeah. Fatigue, right.
Right, particularly being fatigued. So, like, I mean, I know it's one to say, oh, these do seem like random occurrences, and it's just very, you know, a coincidence in sort of ways that these guys got hurt in the way that they got hurt. But falling down a lot, look at Anthony Davis, another guy who falls down a lot. I mean, a lot of times that's because people are not working at their optimal selves. And so I don't, you know, I think it can be both things, right? I think that, like, LeBron is finding the convenient narrative, but there's also some real truth in this, that some of these injuries that we're seeing, even if we think that they're random, they're not really. And I think if we just look at the quality of the basketball, man, these guys are gassed. Like, the way people have been falling down in game sevens. I mean, if you watch the end of the Nets-Bucks game, I mean, those dudes were gassed. Like, just, they were barely able to get up and down the floor. In the overtime, they scored 6 total points. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I do think that, like, the way that the NBA has set this season up has made it so that the players are more likely to get injured, and that this is, like, obviously an unprecedented run of injuries. It doesn't have to mean everything. It doesn't mean that, like, the NBA did anything wrong, that they're, you know, that they could have chosen an option that wouldn't have made players get hurt. But I do think that, like, we should think about the fact that, yeah, no, I mean, it's possible that, like, some of those injuries we're talking about, that they're not random. Like, this is stuff that happens at the end of a very long season, in a particularly difficult season.
Yeah, I mean, those are all really good points. And I think maybe the thing that we can all agree on is that it's just not possible to know on an individual level what causes an injury. And so I think the two points coming out of that are, you know, maybe the most important thing about this going forward is what the players think and what they're saying, which is why I think it's smart for you to lead with LeBron James's tweet, because this is the guy who invented and brought on the player empowerment era. And what did the player empowerment era mean? It meant that superstars, and I guess only superstars, had the ability to decide where they play and who they play with. And so maybe the next phase is that superstars get to decide when they play, too. We've already started to see that. I mean, I referenced Kyrie Irving already, but there's, you know, the load management stuff, which the NBA has pushed back on and saying stars need to play more in nationally televised games, and just different rules about when and how you can sit out due to rest. But I think with what we've seen this year and what the players clearly think is what's happening, I think there's going to be a lot more both kind of public statements and in terms of actions with players just saying, you know, I know my body, I know what it takes to be in optimal condition, and so I'm just going to play when I think and when my team thinks it's appropriate for me to play. And that has nothing to do with what is on the NBA schedule.
Right. And that's a culmination of years of discussion and research and data about the load on elite athletes. And, you know, from, you know, pounding to sleep to travel to nutrition, we know so much more about how athletes' bodies are affected by being elite athletes than we ever did. And that is a reality. So the tension is what the tension will always be. Will league owners and management, team owners and management, accede to the notion that we should be playing less, because fewer games means less revenue. But less revenue also means less to share with the players. This is a tangled knot that, you know, I think the players are going to, as you say, Josh, I mean, this is where it's really helpful. Are the players willing to take a stand on, you know, in favor of their own health that might have a revenue effect on their earnings? Or will ownership just use it as an excuse to try to extract more concessions out of players the next time they collectively bargain?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I don't know, like, what is the most pressing issue here, right? Like, anybody that follows the NBA at NBA Twitter, you know that there's a narrative that, oh, the players don't care about the regular season. There's so many games they will sit out. Some games are not competitive. And in fact, that the regular season is almost totally divorced from the postseason in terms of, like, strategy and everything else. Like, an example being the defensive player of the year, Rudy Gobert, being played off the floor in the playoffs every year for the last 4 or 5 years because he can't defend the pick and roll, right? Well, he's
also like the offenses for the Bucks and the Sixers being so great in the regular season and then just looking horrible in the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah.
At times.
Right. And it's just like, I mean, we know that the competitive intensity of the regular season is totally different from the postseason. So is like, do we know, like, if the NBA decided to cut back to like a 65-game season or a 60-game season, if maybe the players have more energy and they're more invested and you might see more of a competitive brand of ball, and maybe that might increase interest. Like, we just don't know, right? But I do think that long-term, protecting your players, protecting your stars is probably the better play for the NBA. Like, wouldn't you rather have an extra couple years of LeBron than like burning through him early? Or, you know, I think about like going back the day, because people talked about how much the players played, 20, 30 years ago. And I realized like Isaiah Thomas' career was basically done when he was like 31 years old. And like, nobody wants that. Like, we want to see these great players play longer. And I think that that's what the NBA should be investing in. Like, not the 74th game of the season between the Bulls and the Timberwolves, right? Like, maybe like thinking, having a broader, more long-term view of the health of their players and the health of their game is the way to go about this. But I know that that's tough, because why would you leave money on the table? Like, you know, these networks are willing to pay for so many games. And if you change that, then, you know, maybe that could throw things off. I don't know.
Yeah.
Adam Silver seems to be willing to entertain these kinds of questions. I mean, there has been conversation about shortening the regular season. I mean, if any league is going to sort of look at this stuff in a sort of holistic way, it's probably the NBA.
Let's talk about Nets, Bucks, and Hawks, Sixers, because some of these issues were in play in both series. And, you know, Joel, you mentioned how gassed everybody was in OT of the Nets, Bucks game. I mean, if you look at it from the Nets side in particular, I think both teams actually, that condition of exhaustion was imposed on the teams by their coaches.
Yeah, like, right.
There were many, I don't know how good they were. I mean, they're NBA players, so they're of reasonable quality. But it wasn't like there weren't other like men in uniform on the benches who could have come into the game at certain points.
Can I ask a question? Does DeAndre Jordan still play for the Nets?
What about being played off the floor, Joel? You know,
you were
talking about before this issue around injuries and stuff that's particular to this season runs into the fact that the playoffs are different, that teams and players are willing to be on a knife's edge in the playoffs, that Kevin Durant coming off of an Achilles, I mean, it wasn't like super recent at this point, but he's playing every minute of these games and doing it like happily. And I think as fans and people that are concerned about players' health, we're not worried about the fact that he's playing. It's like it's the reason that he is who he is that he plays every minute of game 7 and puts on one of the most amazing performances that I think any of us have ever seen. And that performance, back to like the whole player empowerment super team thing, not to get too heavy, but it's like, you know, you can have a lot of people around you. You can have people that care about you. You can have people that love you. But, you know, sometimes you're just on your own, Joel and Stefan. Sometimes you just got to do it by yourself. And, you know, Durant out there with like Harden on one leg with no Kyrie, it is just fundamentally true for all that we like want these guys to be, you know, to have the ability to play where they want to play, and we think that's all well and good. But it's just more fun to see like Kevin Durant do that and like be his like ultimate offensive weapon self. And it's there's never been anybody like that guy. I mean, and what he was able to do in that game was amazing.
But he is the asteroid.
Yeah, that's right. Shout out Sam Anderson. I mean, I guess like I do think that there's something to be said for watching Kevin Durant push himself to like his edge, right? To play in such a way that it's like, oh, like he could not possibly do any more in terms of maximizing his performance and endurance or whatever else. But I also just think, man, that's sad. I don't quite enjoy it as much as I do seeing like guys be fresh and play like great at the end of the game. Like I know that, yeah, I'm probably splitting hairs.
That's fun too.
Yeah, right. I'm probably splitting hairs here. And that doesn't mean I want to see more Bruce Brown and Joe Harris. But it does mean that, like, I feel so, like, you remember, I guess it was like 6 finals ago when Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving were out and LeBron had to basically play every minute and do every damn thing. And I was just like, yeah, it's cool to see LeBron like have to like go hero mode. But I also was like, man, wouldn't it just be better though if like everybody was healthy and we could just see the best possible basketball where everybody's getting a little bit of a break, you know, maybe take 4 minutes off at a game.
You just like when people get a break. I can relate to that. Stephen.
I mean, there was this expectation that we were going to see Durant, Harden, and Irving together. I mean, they hadn't played together but for like, what, 43 seconds or something during the regular season?
I think that's an exaggeration.
But yeah. But the notion was that we were going to see after this crazy season in which there were injuries and Kyrie took a breather, you know, took a little sabbatical and everyone started to heal. Durant was out for a while. That we would get this. So there was this disappointment that, oh, we're not seeing the fulfillment of the greatness. And then we got to see the second part of the narrative, which was like Kevin Durant being all three of them at once. And that was amazing. And there is something so remarkable about watching peak athletes perform at their peak in hero mode. You know, we'll never forget what Kevin Durant did. And like, I can't think of another instance where, you know, the dude went 0 for 6 in overtime. But nobody, including himself, didn't seem upset or going to blame him for anything because we just saw one of the most remarkable performances that we're ever going to see on a basketball
court.
I thought that was pretty striking too. Just sort of the way Durant like handled the end of the game reminded me that for the athletes themselves, there isn't this like overarching disappointment in losing. It's the acceptance and like seeing him on the court at the end of that game was like, man, I did everything I could, and congrats to you guys.
I think Stefan is filibustering because he doesn't want to talk about what the Sixers did yesterday.
Oh, man.
Is that why you did that? Because, I mean, I think before we get out of this segment, we should just talk about the collapse of the process just for a second because, I mean, I don't know when the last time was that I felt sorry for, you know, a millionaire athlete in that situation, but, like, it, to the extent that you can feel the capacity for empathy for somebody that's wealthy, great, handsome, has a good life. I was like, man, Ben Simmons, man, I felt so bad for that dude.
I thought you were going to say you felt bad for Joel Embiid.
Joel Embiid being
stuck with Ben Simmons. It is. I do take, I think, a perverse amount of glee in the fact that whenever the process doesn't work out, because you know what? The process for the Hawks was get one good player. They got Trae Young, and now they seem pretty good. Whereas the Sixers are like, we're so smart, we're going to like get all of these good players, and what could possibly go wrong? We can't possibly lose. Oh, well. But the Simmons thing and him getting the ball under the basket right at the end of the game and just refusing to shoot, not shooting in the fourth quarter of like
refusing
most
to
of these
dunk,
games.
Joel, refusing to dunk.
But yeah. I do feel bad for him, and it seems like he's the closest we've gotten to a basketball player with like Steve Sachs, Chuck Knoblauch, Rick Ankiel situation. And it's always a bad idea to bet against talent. And this guy is just amazingly talented. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he figures it out. But man, it is really, really rough to watch what became of him in these playoffs.
In our next segment, we talk about how the Supreme Court handed the NCAA its biggest L to date.
On this week's bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to grill Joel about the U.S. track and field trials. And the names we're going to want to know going into the Olympics, including 100-meter stars Sha'Carri Richardson and Trayvon Brummell. To hear that discussion, you have to be a Slate Plus member. You don't just have to be. You're going to want to be. You get bonus segments on this show and other Slate podcasts. You also get all your Slate podcasts ad-free, and you get unlimited reading on Slate.com. It's only $1 for the first month if you want to try it out. You can sign up at Slate.com/HangUpPlus. That's Slate.com/HangUpPlus.
Hey,
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The Supreme Court on Monday handed down what was immediately pronounced one of the most important decisions in the history of sports law. The case is NCAA v. Alston, and while the ruling was narrow, the court found that the NCAA can't restrict payments by schools to athletes for some academic-related expenses. The potential legal and practical consequences could be enormous, up to and including the death of the NCAA as we know it. Mark Joseph Stern, who covers the courts and the law for Slate, joins us now. Hey, Mark.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Often with Supreme Court rulings, you have to clear out the legal underbrush to understand what the justices are saying. Not so here. This ruling was unanimous, and it includes stark and plain language that undermines the entire historical justification for college sports as a quote-unquote amateur enterprise.
Yes, that's absolutely right. This is a pretty easy opinion to understand. I think anyone could pick it up and sort of grasp the bottom line here, which is that the Supreme Court is highly skeptical of the sort of baseline fundamental theory that the NCAA has used for many, many decades to justify what would be in any other context overt monopolistic price fixing and cartel-like anti-competition control.
And the concurrence from Brett Kavanaugh laid that out in much starker and fierier terms. Fierier is a hard word to say.
You should say that the majority opinion was written by another Trump appointee, Neil Gorsuch.
That's right. Both of Trump's male appointees were on board, as was Justice Amy Coney Barrett. The entire court was united here. And the only difference, I guess, is that Kavanaugh may have gone farther if he had the votes this time around. But Gorsuch still did a pretty good job sort of just walloping the NCAA every which way.
So the Kavanaugh concurrence was interesting to me, Mark, both because of the language that he used. I thought he did a good job in kind of putting it in terms that anyone could understand, like restaurants can't come together to cut cooks' wages on the theory that customers prefer to eat food from low-paid cooks. I mean, that seems like a fair and accurate analogy. But based on my reading of it, it seemed like he was actively inviting further and more expansive challenges to the NCAA model, basically saying, doesn't seem like it would really withstand scrutiny if somebody wants to come and challenge us more. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me give a little background to explain why that makes sense. What happened here is that a number of current and former student athletes challenged several different rules that the NCAA imposes on its members. One of those rules is, of course, no direct compensation for playing sports. Another one of the rules is a really tight cap on education-related benefits. And so that could include scholarships for future academic programs like graduate school or vocational school. It could include money for laptops, for tutoring, that kind of thing. And the lower court upheld the NCAA's ban on direct compensation, but prohibited the NCAA's really tight cap on educational benefits. And both of those decisions flowed from the central argument here that the NCAA put forward, which is that consumers of sports love watching unpaid people compete. And that is how Amy Coney Barrett put it during oral arguments, and that's exactly what the NCAA argued. You know, apparently consumers love amateurism. They love amateur sports. There's a huge cluster of consumers out there who draw a really bright line between amateur sports and professional sports and feel that if amateur players were allowed to be paid by their schools, that the entire sport would fundamentally change and people wouldn't want to watch it anymore. And the demand for college athletics would dry up because all of these consumers would huff and puff and say, we cannot accept these paid players. They're not amateurs to us anymore. So the Supreme Court did not actually hear that first part of the lower court's decision. The Supreme Court did not consider in this case whether the ban on direct compensation is lawful or not. Nobody appealed that part of the ruling. That stood no matter what. This case was only about those education-related benefits. And so here, the Supreme Court unanimously said, look, no one is going to think that amateur athletes are not amateur because they're getting education-related benefits. If anything, those benefits highlight the fact that these people are students in school, not professionals. And the court did not address the, I think, more pressing issue of direct compensation. And what Brett Kavanaugh is doing in his concurrence is teeing that up for a future case. He's saying, all right, guys, I understand this particular question didn't make it to the court this time, but we have now kind of laid the groundwork to answer it, and I am very ready and enthusiastic and excited for that case to come to us because I really think that the reasoning of today's decision should also undermine the NCAA's ban on direct compensation to athletes.
This is, I guess, why, so, you know, if Brett Kavanaugh says that, he's inviting another challenge, and I think that's why so many people that support athletes getting paid and being able to avail themselves of all the, you know, financial opportunities out there were so they seemed a little bit more pessimistic about this. And I wonder if that's because, I mean, consider that Alston v. NCAA started in 2012. This is 2021. So any challenge, Mark, right? Wouldn't that just, I mean, we're talking, you know, years in the future, possibly with a completely different Supreme Court at that point, right?
It's going to take a while. And any kind of antitrust case takes a while to work its way up through the courts, in part because they're very fact-sensitive disputes. And that's what accounts for the kind of split decision below in this case, where the judge held like a 10-day trial. She amassed a ton of evidence and eventually decided, okay, well, the amateurism argument can cut the mustard when it comes to direct payments, but not for education-related benefits. So if students want to now go back, build off this Supreme Court decision and argue, actually, the whole amateur argument doesn't hold water for direct payments either, they're going to have to build up a record. They're going to have to show not only that this is a restraint on trade, but that it has the effect of reducing competition, that it does not actually benefit consumers. And that's, I think, a kind of difficult thing to show. I mean, there is a lively debate in this country about whether not paying college athletes is the right thing to do. And many people who argue that it is the right thing to do, that paying college athletes will change the nature of the game. It will make the sport more professionalized and dry up consumer interest in it. And so, you know, that's going to take a long time at the trial court. And no matter how the trial court rules, it's going to have to slowly trickle up through the appeals court and to SCOTUS, which, you know, we could all be dead by then.
But Kavanaugh also in his concurrence did signal, which justices often do, right, Mark? Like, go figure out a better way here. At one point, he says these difficult questions could be resolved in ways other than litigation. Legislation would be one option, or colleges and student athletes could potentially engage in collective bargaining to provide student athletes a fairer share of the revenues that they generate for their colleges.
Image, and likeness legislation is going into effect in six states coming up within a week. And so we have the NCAA here feeling pressure from a bunch of different sides, both about any future litigation that might be inspired by this ruling, but also the grounds moving underneath them legislatively at the state level and maybe at the federal level soon.
Yeah. And first of all, I never, ever in my entire life expected Brett Kavanaugh to use the words collective bargaining in a positive way. Like, that was kind of shocking. Second, I think he's onto something here. And his example of the ability of athletes to use their likeness to profit from their publicity, that's kind of a success story in this area, right? Because athletes demanded it, the NCAA resisted, states started passing these laws nonetheless, and eventually the NCAA caved. And I think that's
Well, the NCAA hasn't quite caved. The NCAA is...
partially.
Retrenched. Retrenched is right. I mean, sort of hired some more lobbyists to try to figure out ways to protect itself.
Right. A number of states have passed laws allowing college athletes to make money off of their publicity, off of their image, and the NCAA is considering softening its stance there, feeling pressure from the state legislation. And I think that these are really complicated questions, and sometimes the answers need to be nuanced and need to come from lawmakers. And I think that if Congress could step in here and craft a solution that really did benefit college athletes and provide a clear answer, everyone would be much better off than a single Supreme Court decision just declaring up or down, you have to give them fair market value or you're allowed to keep, you know, using forced labor. It's difficult for courts to resolve these questions on their own. And that's something that Gorsuch actually hints toward in his opinion, where he suggests that, you know, if, as a general rule, courts don't want to be in the business of crafting these really broad public policy rules, just using a really short statute like the Sherman Act.
Joel, I'm curious for your thoughts on this seeming like maybe the only bipartisan issue in America. I mean, you can see it in the unanimity of the court opinion, but also Republican and Democratic members of Congress have talked about the NCAA in very harsh terms and the need for reform here. And it might seem obvious to us, and the facts of the case might seem obvious, but it's just so striking how John Paul Stevens in 1984, who's not seen as a reactionary, wrote about the NCAA playing a critical role in the maintenance of a revered tradition of amateurism in college sports. And so, Joel, do you think that just like the political winds have changed? Have more people just become aware of the fact that this is wrong and unfair?
Well, you all, you know, can second guess me on this, right? But I just, don't you just think that this is more of Americans' increasing distrust of institutions? Like, it's easy to hate the NCAA. It's easy to hate the media. It's easy to hate, you know, any institution that has gotten rich in like the last, you know, few decades, right? And so people look at it skeptically, but that doesn't mean, at least to me, that people are on the side of paying athletes. Like that, you know, these are two separate things. And the NCAA has always been sort of a dodge to me. And Mark, maybe you can correct me this or Stefan and Josh, but like the NCAA is just a group of institutions. It wouldn't take anything for like 50, like Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, UCLA, Washington, to just form a whole nother organization based around giving extra, you know, postgraduate scholarships to athletes and saying, okay, well, that's the way we're going to compensate because we don't have to pay and we can compensate our athletes in that way, right? Like, I mean, I know that this seems bipartisan, but I don't think that it means that people are on the side of the athletes getting paid. I just think it means that it's easy to bang on an institution that is unpopular and increasingly so, but that doesn't mean that, like, you know, the fundamentals of amateurism are threatened here. Does that make sense?
You know, I don't know that I agree. And I wonder whether the real, like really what's happening here is this decades long drip toward something that is equitable and right, and that people will just come to accept it because of all of the change that occurs. I mean, maybe this is a terrible analogy, but I wonder if it's not a little bit like marriage equality, that, you know, we go decades and decades with firm, clear public opinion polling opposition, and then suddenly, oh, the majority of the country thinks this is totally fine. And I wonder whether once college athletes are paid – their market value or something closer to it, people will just be like, oh yeah, of course, they should get paid some money. They're making billions of dollars from the TV rights. So I do think this is part of this slow continuum, and it's slower than a lot of us would like, but this is a huge development in sort of the affirmation that the Supreme Court is, you know, agrees with progressive sports analysts that this system is just completely unfair and fucked.
I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, most polling shows that, like, I mean, the most recent poll that I could find, which is from, you know, a few years ago, that, like, something that close to, like, 3/4 of white people disapprove of paying college athletes.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, in 10 or 20 years, will we look back on this, like, what was the big deal? Like, of course we ended up where we ended up. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic.
Two quick points here. First of all, I don't want to overestimate the average American's deep interest in antitrust law or the Sherman Act, but I do think there is an emerging hostility toward monopolies and toward like this cartel-like use of market power to suppress pay, with varying degrees of sophistication and understanding exactly how it works. But you see when, you know, Congress, when the Senate confirms Lina Khan to the Federal Trade Commission by a very bipartisan vote, that is Republican in the Senate showing that they care about antitrust, that they are concerned about monopolies. And I think that this renewed interest in monopoly power could be driving some of this bipartisan skepticism. Number two, there is a social justice element here, and it's one that, surprisingly to me, Brett Kavanaugh brings up in his opinion. He says the student athletes who generate the revenues, many of them are African American and from lower income backgrounds who end up with little or nothing, and cites the brief for African American antitrust lawyers, not a brief I expected Kavanaugh to cite here. And so I think that to the extent that conservatives may be increasingly hostile to large corporations that present themselves as woke and also exercise monopoly power. Liberals are hostile toward corporations that manipulate and abuse minorities and use their labor to bring billions of dollars to already wealthy people. There is a common ground here. And even if conservatives and liberals may have different reasons for their skepticism toward the NCAA, at the end of the day, they can come together and maybe agree over this particular issue.
I think Mark said that I was right.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you said it was a good institution. I feel like I won that one, Steph. I'm sorry.
Sure. Well, but the movement, and I think this is in Kavanaugh's opinion too, is that if someone like Brett Kavanaugh says something, well, more conservatives are going to start to believe it. And does that change the way that, you know, the people that you might think of as prototypical big college donors and boosters start to think? I mean, Kavanaugh says here, the bottom line is that the NCAA and its member colleges are suppressing the pay of student athletes who collectively generate billions of dollars in revenues for colleges every year.
What I would say is that a really common argument you hear from the kind of like median troglodytic college sports fan is that
and he knows, having read Tiger Droppings, the LSU
is that athletes who are not satisfied with getting a scholarship and an education are ungrateful, and I would play for free, so why would they dare ask for more than that? But the other thing that the median troglodytic sports fan cares about is winning. And if and when the rules change, they will be totally fine with athletes getting paid. And then the next frontier will be like, oh, Alabama's cheating and paying. I mean, it's a very kind of like typical kind of back and forth cycle. And Joel, I know you know it well, but I do feel like Stefan is onto the fact that people will change their minds and not acknowledge that their minds have been changed and just figure out something new to be mad about.
It did not take long in the arc of history in sports for fans to go from, oh my God, we're paying Claudel Washington $300,000 a year to play baseball, to everybody being an armchair GM and analyzing the salary cap and how much each team is spending and urging them to spend more. I think something very similar will happen with college football and basketball.
I hope you all are right. I'm much more cynical about the resistance people have to seeing Black people thrive in this country. And so I think that that may be an element that will still be foundational in any of these arguments going forward. But maybe you all will be right. Maybe it will change and I will be pleasantly surprised. But I haven't seen anything happening in the last decade that indicates to me that people are going to become more enlightened about like a racial justice issue, which is essentially Black players being cut out of the wealth that they generate for these major institutions.
So just one piece of speculation here. It may be that with this decision, the horses are already out of the barn. Because, as I said, the court really undermines the legal theory that the NCAA has used to fix prices for all of these years to you know, suppress competition. And now the Supreme Court has opened the door to kind of secondary backdoor ways for colleges to compensate athletes. I mean, we're not supposed to say that, but and we should all agree that, you know, like a scholarship for grad school is a worthy thing and is categorically different from direct compensation. But I think that schools are going to be able to use this decision to start offering increasingly lavish benefits to students that are putatively tied to education. And this is what the NCAA feared. And Gorsuch kind of pushes it aside and says, "Ah, that's not going to happen." But I don't know if that's right. The NCAA speculates about, you know, athletes hiring limousines to take them to games and the school having to pay for it. I don't think I'd go that far. But you can imagine increasingly nice computers, technology given to student athletes, payment for various trips and training, all of these ways that athletes could get more money and more, you know, perks that leads to more competition that eventually creates a system where schools say, we would rather just pay them, because having to deal with these kind of tricky backdoor remunerations is more complicated than just cutting them a check.
We haven't talked about the NCAA statement. You all tell me your impression of this. Like, it feels to me that the NCAA didn't consider itself losing. Did you, their statement was, while today's decision preserves the lower court ruling, it also reaffirms the NCAA's authority to adopt reasonable rules and repeatedly notes that the NCAA remains free to articulate what are and what are not truly educational benefits consistent with the NCAA's mission to support student athletes. Even though the decision does not directly address name, image, and likeness, the NCAA remains committed to supporting NIL benefits for student athletes. Additionally, we remain committed to working with Congress to chart a path forward, which is a point the Supreme Court expressly stated in its ruling. That doesn't sound like...
What do you think they're going to say, Joel?
They're going to fight this till the end.
Destroyed?
Of course. But I mean, it just doesn't... I mean, of course, like, obviously, that's they're going to put up a stoic face in the wake of this. But I mean, it feels to me that, like, I mean, they're not going to roll over. And I mean, the NCAA is pretty much undefeated in the history, in the course of amateur athletics in this country. The NCAA, to me at least, is undefeated. So, well, you guys disagree with me. I'm the only one. Mark, come on and help and rally to my defense here.
The NCAA is going to try to police the boundaries of this decision and strictly limit it. And I am just not convinced that it is going to be able to. I don't think that the category of education-related benefits is as narrow as either party makes it out to be. I think that when this is implemented in the real world, we're going to discover a lot more ways for schools to provide these perks to athletes, and that the NCAA is just not going to be able to police this decision to the extent that it doesn't expand to its logical limits and possibly even beyond that.
The NCAA is going to be holding on to its rule book while it gets into the Titanic lifeboat. I mean, there's no doubt that they're just going to keep hiring lobbyists and lawyers to try to fight this until they can't fight it anymore. And then once they're done losing, they're going to say, well, of course it's time to pay athletes their fair share.
Which is pretty much what they did with sports betting, or what they're on track to do with sports betting. You know, took New Jersey to court, tried to say, you know, sports betting needs to remain illegal. And when the Supreme Court struck down the federal ban on sports betting, the NCAA turned around and said, oh, well, we'll think about this one, and is probably trying to figure out a way to work within the system of sports betting now as well.
Mark Joseph Stern covers the courts, the Supreme Court, the law for Slate. Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next, David Epstein joins us to talk about Shelby Houlihan's doping suspension.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The U.S. track and field trials got underway in Oregon this past week. And if you want to hear about who showed up and who to watch at the Olympics, then you should stay tuned for our Slate Plus segment later in the show. But for now, we're going to talk about an athlete who did not run. 28-year-old Shelby Houlihan holds the American records in the 1500 and the 5000 meters. But earlier this month, the Court of Arbitration for Sport upheld a four-year doping suspension against Houlihan, a ruling that, if it doesn't get overturned by some mechanism at some point, will knock her out of both the Tokyo Games starting next month and the 2024 Olympics in Paris. Houlihan tested positive for the anabolic steroid nandrolone, and the story she's telling is that she ingested that steroid via a burrito she ordered from a food truck. Joining us now is David Epstein. He is the author of the books The Sports Gene and Range, and you can hear him on the Slate podcast, How To. Dave, thank you for being with us to discuss Shelby Houlihan's burrito.
My pleasure. And by the way, she's definitely out of Tokyo now, no matter what, because she's now missed the trials. So she's out for sure.
There we go. All right. A correction right away. I love it. So a little look behind the scenes for you guys. Dave is often telling me what I'm right and wrong about when I ask him, not unsolicited. But as soon as I heard about this story, I started bothering him about it because it seemed so ridiculous. And I haven't gotten to the most amazing part in the introduction, which is that Shelby Houlihan claims she ordered a carne asada burrito, which is a beef burrito, but that she ingested the nandrolone because she'd eaten pig offal. So she was alleging burrito cross-contamination. But Dave, you told me that you don't think her story is so ridiculous, or actually, if it is ridiculous, you don't think it has much bearing on whether she's innocent or guilty.
I think there are a lot of different issues here, Josh. Let's start with the burrito. The burrito you should always start with the burrito. The burrito story is improbable, right? She didn't order the pig offal. That said, there are a lot of improbable stories here, and she had to try to establish the source of the nandrolone in order for her appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And they were appealing on a technical matter that hasn't really been in the news, which is that if it is meat contamination as opposed to like injected nandrolone, the testing procedure is actually different. So with a female athlete, first they check, are they pregnant? Because there's some natural nandrolone if they're pregnant. When they say they're not, it goes to this other testing area. And then there's another split in what happens depending on if it turns out that it was naturally produced by, you know, some other animal, or was it injectable? And so they were forced to argue the case to try to come up with some plausible story. So nandrolone, I will say, when I reported on baseball, it was when someone would say they had a false positive test, it was a supplement, I always said BS. Except I came around on nandrolone specifically because it's a common contaminant and it's the single easiest thing to test for. So even baseball's sorry ass testing basically kicked out nandrolone of use, because if you inject it, which is how people typically use it, it's detectable for months. Okay. And so if the answer is you actually don't know where it came from, if it was legitimate contamination, you still have to come up with some story for the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And so I'm stuck choosing between improbable stories, which is athletes have to be crazy to dope with nandrolone for years now. And Houlihan took, you know, she gave a hair sample. She had other tests around it that were negative. So she's probably not injecting it, or those tests would have been positive. So it's improbable that someone would be taking it orally in the first place. So that's improbable. It doesn't work as well orally. It's the burrito story improbable. I'm stuck between these improbable stories of maybe they don't know where it came from. It is a common contaminant. Nandrolone makes up most of the positive tests that the Athletics Integrity Unit finds overall. We know it gets injected into meat illegally. Versus the chance that she was for some reason taking it orally, which would be very rare and the stupidest thing you could possibly take. So I'm sort of stuck between these improbable stories, but my reflex these days when someone tests positive for nandrolone is to think that may be accidental because it's like the one substance that everyone knows not to take on purpose anymore, but it's still a common contaminant.
But wait, Dave, so are you seriously? So is your sense then that people really don't mean to take nandrolone anymore as a performance enhancing drug? Because I remember even going back to the 90s, like Linford Christie, Merlinati, yeah. like yeah. great Olympic sprint champions tested positive for nandrolone yeah. and were suspended, yeah. right? So yeah. is your sense then that it really is like fallen out of favor with elite athletes because it's so easy to detect?
Yeah, I think as testing has gotten somewhat better and more truly random, it quickly fell out of favor because if you're injecting it, which again is the way that people take it, it gets stored in your fat deposits and the metabolites are detectable for like, I mean, I've seen some papers that suggest up to 18 months. I think that's a little far-fetched, but for a long time. And otherwise, I guess you could take it orally. I haven't really heard of people doing that before, and it also wouldn't be as effective. But I do think it's a drug that for professional athlete use kind of went bye-bye when testing became legitimately random and independent.
I'm at once thrilled that the National Pork Board is getting quoted in the media and that there is a discussion about uncastrated boars. I'm just really excited to see that in the press. But it's not that the burrito story is improbable. It's that it's irrelevant. Like you said, she had to make up something because to take your case to the Court of Arbitration of Sport, you need some defense. When the real defense here is that, A, these tests are probably too sensitive now. They're too good. They can detect too small traces of banned substances. And they sort of defy logic because the logic of using nandrolone just doesn't exist anymore, as you just outlined.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, I'm sure there are athletes out there using it, but I can't imagine it's a horrible choice. I know when the Athletics Integrity Unit started and they did a report on doping in Kenya and there were a bunch of positives and everyone was like, there's a huge problem. If you actually look at the breakdown, most of them were nandrolone positives. And I don't think that's because suddenly like the most popular drug is the stupidest one to dope for. I think it's because it actually is kind of a common contaminant. This is not to say that Shelby Houlihan is not doping. I think I find the boar burrito story to be improbable, but I also find it improbable that an athlete in her position took the last thing she should have taken and that somehow the tests around it also like tested negative. And again, not only did they have to make some case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, they had to make a case specifically establishing the source to say that the wrong testing pathway was gone down. And so if the answer is you don't know what the source is, you still have to come up with something.
So Lindsay Krauss in the Times did a really good piece last month about Brenda Martinez, the Olympian who nearly got banned for taking an antidepressant. And she came back, she tested positive for a diuretic that could be used as a masking agent. That diuretic was not on the label. And the reason that they found out it was in there was that when she tested positive, they sent it off to a lab to get tested and it was found to contain this diuretic. And the story is really heartbreaking. Well, A, Brenda Martinez had to kind of come out and talk about and declare that she was suffering from depression. The bans here are so severe. Like, the Olympics only come around every 4 years. It's what you're training for your whole life. And if you get, you know, like Shelby Houlihan, as you said, she's not going to get they're not going to like, you know, hold the Tokyo Olympics again next year. They're not going to like delay it for a week to give her another chance. And so if you do get falsely accused or falsely or suspended for a bad reason, like you can't really recover from that. And so there are these really heartbreaking stories, and Brenda Martinez thankfully is going to be able to run. She was able to prove her case. When you read something like that, Dave, it again puts you in this uncomfortable position of like, if Shelby Houlihan is telling the truth, feeling very bad for her. And if she's lying, as a lot of athletes have done in the past when they've been suspended or accused, then it's really a terrible thing given what happens to like people like Brenda Martinez who are like legitimately stung by this system.
Yeah. And I mean, this doesn't bear on her guilt or innocence, but this is like the worst 4-year ban you could possibly imagine because the delayed Tokyo Olympics now make it a 2 Olympic ban instead of a one Olympic ban. But that doesn't bear on her guilt or innocence, though. But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but Brenda Martinez's case was her positive test came through the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, where Shelby Houlihan's came through the Athletics Integrity Unit that was established in 2017 to sort of beef up drug testing. And I think the Athletics Integrity Unit...
Pork up.
What's that?
We said beef up pork up.
To pork up, right, to uncastrated pork up the drug testing. And I think they set low thresholds. So had Houlihan tested with a higher level of nandrolone, it would have just automatically been an adverse finding and none of that technical issue of how it should be tested could have occurred. But I think the Athletics Integrity Unit has sort of implicitly said, you know, we're kind of willing to accept some more potential false positives to get more dopers. And that's a trade-off, you know, you make.
How do you feel about that trade-off?
Gosh, that is a tough one.
Because this... Okay, let's assume that she did take the nandrolone. The like trace amount here, would there even be a performance benefit for taking this?
Or I guess it depends on when she took it and how long it was leaving her system, right?
I mean, if she was taking this nandrolone purposely, then it seems to me for sure it would have been orally, because if it were injected, which is the only way that I had heard of athletes taking it when I was doing doping reporting in sports, but you could take it orally if you wanted to. If she had injected it, her tests around that and her hair sample test that she gave would have also been positive. So if she's taking it intentionally, she's taking it orally. It would clear more quickly orally. So it'd be less effective, but it would clear more quickly. So it depends how close to someone taking it you end up testing them.
Can we just take a 30,000 foot view for here for a second there? Because I guess like, okay, let's say you catch Shelby Houlihan, right? By no means should anybody believe that means that all of a sudden there's going to be a clean Olympics and that none of the runners, nobody tested positive, right? So I guess, like at this point, like, don't you, it just feels like testing is sort of like an antiquated, testing for what people are testing for and the way that they're testing for it is sort of an antiquated notion now for athletes in the way that they prepare and train. Is that fair or do you feel differently about it?
I don't know. I mean, you're definitely right that they're not, no matter what threshold they set, right? So my take is that setting low thresholds for things like nandrolone means like most of the even moderately savvy dopers will still get through, and you're going to catch a lot of people who accidentally ingested something. I think there's like pretty decent research that suggests to me that in track and field in the Olympics, there's probably about 30 to maybe 50% of the athletes have doped at one point or another. And you're certainly not getting that many positives. You know, usually it's like 2% a year or something like that. I think there, for a lot of years when I was sort of reporting more actively on doping, it was almost like lockstep, like there'd be a technological improvement in drug testing. But then, you know, dopers would adjust. And so you'd see between 1% to 2% of tests would be positive every year, even while there was technological change. I think the biological passport has made a little improvement on that, which is where instead of looking for a drug or its metabolites, you test people repeatedly over time and you look for signature like fluctuations in their blood levels. So there was like a cycling team. I got some documents leaked from at one point where when biological passports started, they all started looking like they were identical twins. So they had to dope less. And clearly, they were engineering their blood levels in an unnatural way. So they were still doping, but they had to dope less. And I think things like biological passport put athletes today at a doping disadvantage compared to athletes of many years past. And I think one of the places you see that is a lot of the women's records are still stuck in like the 80s and early 90s when you could really dope with very little chance of getting caught. So I think people have to dope less now, but I still think the research suggests it's probably like a third to a half of track and field athletes who have doped at some point.
But then are we potentially being stuck with the notion that people that are getting caught are, in fact, not doping? I mean, a couple of these stories that have gotten some attention in the wake of the Houlihan case are astounding. This Jarian Lawson, the Olympic American long jumper, ate a beef teriyaki bowl at a Japanese restaurant in 2018, tested positive for a metabolite of trenbolone, and then his agent had to go track down the beef supplier for the restaurant, and he was exonerated because of text messages that in which he like said what he was going to go have for lunch. And his agent said had he ordered the chicken bowl instead of the beef bowl, he would have saved himself $2 million and his reputation. This seems just absurd.
It's incredibly improbable, but that turned out to be true, right? And luckily, they were able to establish a source. Like, people inject, whether legally or illegally, people inject steroids into animals for the same reasons they inject them into humans, more meat, right? That happens. You can imagine people don't like care a lot about injecting into animals. So those things happen. You just have to hope that you get lucky to establish the source. I mean, so that's where I'm concerned about the Athletics Integrity Unit, which is, again, that I think the savvy dopers, you know, are still largely going to get through, even though I think Biological Passport and sort of human intelligence gathering has made some improvements. But just doing sort of the threshold lowering in the absence of anything else, I don't think you're going to get a lot more real dopers, but I think you're going to, some maybe, but you're going to get a lot more sort of accidental cases. And you know, fortunately for a lot of athletes in the U.S., they like get legal representation and appeal. And a lot of other places, they don't really have those, you know, so athletes from poorer places just like fade away and don't end up fighting those fights.
So maybe we can end with kind of a conversation about branding, the ways in which athletes, and I think distance runners in particular, Dave, there's just this reputation that people on certain teams have, and certain athletes kind of make it part of their image that they're clean and that they want to get dopers out of the sport. And this team that Shelby Houlihan is on, reputed to be a clean team, right? And that they kind of talk about being clean athletes. And my sense was that that led to a lot of people being kind of disappointed or disillusioned when they heard about Shelby Houlihan. And so I'd like to get your kind of thoughts on both athletes who represent themselves as being clean and make that a big part of their self-identity, and whether that should kind of carry any weight with us, but also about just like the continued capacity for people who follow the sport to be like surprised and disappointed when anyone tests positive for anything.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think self-identification as being clean should not carry a lot of weight. You know, I think we've learned that lesson, you know, from Lance, if no one else, right? I do think there are things you can do, though. Like, you know, I think it would be interesting if Shelby Houlihan decided to release her biological passport data. Like, that would be interesting to look at, because obviously she hasn't been sanctioned because of that. But when you look at someone's biological passport data, you can say, short of someone being sanctioned, like, that doesn't look so good, you know? So I think there's steps that athletes could take. Then again, Lance did that at one point and put on the internet briefly before taking it down a clear doping signature. Somebody must have alerted him after that. But I think people in the running community, there are teams you hear lots of rumors about. And a lot of times those rumors end up bearing out in some way or another. And I would say in the running community, this was not a team that you heard a lot of those rumors about. Doesn't mean someone's not doping. Individuals on an otherwise clean team can be doping on their own. But I think that's part of the disappointment, is that like you hear chatter about teams where things are going on a lot. And this wasn't one of those teams. So I think the disappointment.
But it also could be part of her defense, right?
It could be. But obviously, I think we can't take athletes' grandstanding, you know, at face value necessarily, unfortunately.
But we also need to factor in that these organizations shouldn't be considered above reproach either. There's all sorts of conflicts of interest, particularly in the European ones, the World Anti-Doping Agency, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, overlapping with IOC members. You've got like the head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, Travis Tygart, you know, talking openly about how we're sacrificing innocent athletes. So a lack of trust in this system overall. I mean, it feels like we've gone a little bit from not trusting athletes at all and assuming everyone was doping because that was the, you know, not an unreasonable assumption, to being skeptical of the process by which we attempt to catch athletes.
I mean, it's a political body. Before Rio, when I was at ProPublica, I did an interview with WADA's, a guy who had just left as WADA's first and only investigator, had been a former DA agent, and he just sort of came out openly and said, you know, that his boss was slow walking like the Russia investigations because the head of WADA was an IOC member, right? And so these are political bodies. You know, in many cases, I think international sports governance bodies are like, have all the conflicts of interests of international politics, but with even less of the accountability. Because it's like once the event starts or once the ball rolls out, you know, in the World Cup, it's like everybody ignores that other stuff. So, yeah, I think you have a lot of political conflicts and motivations that have nothing to do with clean sport, basically.
David Epstein is the author of the books The Sports Gene and Range. You can listen to him on the Slate podcast, How To. Dave, always make sure that you know where your food is coming from.
Yeah, just feel free. Anytime you want to talk about uncastrated pigs, you know where to find me.
Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now it is time for After Balls, and we told the story, Stefan, you told the story of Jerrion Lawson in our previous segment, the guy who tested positive because of the teriyaki bowl. Lindsay Krauss in the New York Times in her story about Brenda Martinez included a couple of other examples of what are known as no-fault cases, ones that are overturned because it wasn't the athlete's fault. She mentioned a member of the Olympic softball team and an Olympic hopeful boxer both tested positive, only to find out they'd been exposed to banned substances through sex with their partners. Word to the wise. And then, and I quote, in 2018, a 90-year-old man in Indiana named Carl Grove, who set an age group world record in cycling, tested positive for a metabolite of the anabolic steroid trenbolone. He lost the record and his national title and was issued a warning. The steroid was almost certainly in a liver dish he ate before the race. Stefan, be careful. Be careful about eating liver before you play in those softball games. We don't want your records to get tossed out. Stefan, what is your Carl Grove?
Last week during our conversation about Christian Eriksen of Denmark, I mentioned the 1971 death of Chuck Hughes of the Detroit Lions, the only player to die on the field in an NFL game. I said I remembered it, but barely. I was 8 years old at the time. Hughes was 28, a 5'11", 175-pound wide receiver out of Texas El Paso. He didn't play much. In five NFL seasons, he caught just 15 passes. His only reception in 1971 was on the day that he died, Sunday, October 24th. With 1:38 to play and the Lions trailing the Bears 28-23, Hughes caught a 32-yard pass from Greg Landry to the Chicago 36-yard line. After two more incomplete passes, neither to him, with just over a minute left, Hughes started to jog back to the huddle and collapsed. Bears linebacker Dick Butkus said after the game that he first thought Hughes was acting to earn the Lions an extra timeout. Then I saw his eyes rolling and he turned blue, Butkus said. Photos show Hughes face down, his right arm bent awkwardly. He's wearing a single bar face mask and black Puma cleats. In one shot, a referee is bending over, checking on him. In another, a Lions doctor is performing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Doctors also did CPR on the field. Hughes was placed on a stretcher, fitted with an oxygen mask, and taken to Henry Ford Hospital, where an hour later he was pronounced dead. The players didn't know in the moment what doctors said later, that Hughes had died on the 15-yard line. Unlike Denmark and Belgium, after Eriksen's collapse, the game resumed. The Lions turned the ball over on downs, and the Bears ran out the clock. Even considering the football circumstances, Detroit down five, driving for a winning score, and a half a century of cultural evolution, it seems pretty incredible that, given what everyone had just seen, they finished the game. Listener Daniel Waldron wondered whether there was any contemporaneous pushback. The only thing I found was in a sidebar in the Chicago Tribune that opened with a quote from a tearful Bears receiver named Bob Wallace, who was a college teammate of Chuck Hughes. "I wished they'd called the damn game off," Wallace said. Media coverage included football-free accounts on page one of papers including the Tribune and the New York Times. Sports sections, though, treated Hughes' demise as part of the game story. The headline on the front of the Tribune sports section was "Death Shadows Bears Victory." One Michigan paper used a photo of Hughes on the stretcher with an AP story. The headline, "Lions are handed a 28-23 upset by Bears." The most remarkable media performance, though, might have been Howard Cosell's halftime highlights on Monday Night Football the next day. Cosell opens with 3 minutes of breathless rehashing of Bengals-Raiders and Broncos-Browns. Then there's a commercial break, STP Oil, Firestone Tires. Then, coming out of the break, a shot of the Lions mascot and the Detroit players running on the field.
Tiger Stadium, Detroit, Michigan, the Lions coming out onto the field to face the Chicago Bears in a game that was ultimately to produce the terrible tragedy of Chuck Hughes. This is first quarter action. The Bears trailing 3-0, but Dunshy taking the handoff from southpaw quarterback Bobby Douglas, bursting 21 yards for the touchdown, and the Bears lead it.
The pro shift in tone there by Cosell. The dude is dead. But to the action. To justify continuing with the highlights, a little bit of somber foreshadowing now by Cosell.
No thought at this time of what was to occur later. Second quarter action, 13:15 remaining. Chicago leading 7-6. Bobby Douglas throwing long to George Farmer. Farmer taking the ball.
There's literally two more minutes of game highlights. A Bobby Douglas touchdown pass. His coach moved in with him to prepare for this game. 102-yard kickoff return, another Douglas touchdown throw, an unremarkable interception. You must watch this play closely. Finally, and we're like 7 minutes into the highlights now, here's what we hear.
But the scene is set for fourth quarter action. And with only 4 minutes and 4 seconds gone, Bobby Douglas keeps it, goes in for the score. The Bears win 28-23, but the whole game washed away because of the loss of Chuck Hughes.
So did they cut to a commercial there and the highlights and go back to the booth for some somber chatter? Nope. Before Cosell even finishes saying the loss of Chuck Hughes, we get a tight shot of a white guy in a headdress and face paint. Kansas City Chiefs, Municipal Stadium, Kansas City, the big game of Sunday. Earlier on Monday, the Lions team doctors had announced that Hughes had died of a heart attack. They claimed it was inevitable because of undetected blocked arteries. It turned out that Hughes had collapsed in the locker room after a preseason game 7 weeks earlier and was hospitalized for 4 days. In the subsequent weeks, he complained, even publicly, about chest pains. But doctors said they couldn't find anything wrong and later cleared him to play. An autopsy revealed that Hughes had, in fact, likely suffered a previous heart attack. Hughes's widow sued the hospital and settled out of court.
Wow. This was 1971. Maybe were people just a little less sentimental about death because we were right in the middle of Vietnam or something? Or I don't, you know what I mean? It just seems like, yeah, well, next man up. You know, basically that's what Howard Cosell said.
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought contextually what I think is interesting is that it's the NFL, right? This is the league that kept playing after Kennedy was assassinated. I couldn't find anything in newspapers with a reaction from the league. There was no statement from the NFL's main office. Pete Rozelle, the commissioner, didn't attend Chuck Hughes' funeral. He sent two representatives instead. And the league didn't do anything really afterward. The league didn't sort of force teams to add defibrillators in stadiums. An NFL spokesman told the AP, which did a survey of cardiac care at football stadiums, each club has a qualified physician and will handle such matters individually. So yeah, I think there was a let's move on here, next game, next man up.
I mean, maybe the mentality from the league was, if we don't talk about this or make a big deal of this, then we won't be held liable for this. It does seem like they wanted to make the argument that this had nothing to do with football, that it was just a coincidence that he happened to be playing football when this happened.
No, and it's funny you should mention that, Josh, because the sort of day two stories after the Lions doctors went before the media and sort of covered their asses by saying, hey, this was undetectable. We did all these tests months ago. There was no indication that, you know, that we could have known that Chuck Hughes was a time bomb. The lead of the AP story after that news conference was that football cannot be blamed for the death of Chuck Hughes. And that was actually the headline in lots of newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, the NFL is going to do what it does. It seems like the blame there, a lot of it should go on the media for not being skeptical.
Yeah.
That is our show for today. Our producer this week was Margaret Kelly. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. And don't forget, subscribe to the show, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Be a pal. For Joel Anderson and Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.